John O'Leary and his wife Patricia Cepeda to the Miller Center. I'd like to depart a little bit from the usual practice, and I'd like to introduce Ambassador O'Leary's wife first because of some interesting local connections. Patricia Cepeda, who is over here on my right, grew up in Colombia. Her parents thought it would be good for her self-discipline to be sent away to boarding school, so she went to school outside of Philadelphia, ended up at Yale College in New Haven, and as it happens, her godfather is Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the Nobel Prize-winning author, and she presently serves as his simultaneous interpreter when he goes around, and she's actually served as his interpreter at the White House for a dinner with President Carter, with President Clinton. I learned last night from her that one of the great influences on Marquez was the writings of William Faulkner, and so she was very interested that this would be held in the Faulkner House, and that the original manuscript for The Sound and the Fury is at Alderman Library. And so we've made arrangements for her to go over this afternoon and see the original handwritten manuscript for Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury. So we welcome Patricia. John O'Leary grew up outside of Portland, Maine, and went to Yale as an undergraduate. Did graduate work, got his master's at Cambridge, and then came back to Yale to law school. He met while he was at Yale people whose names are very much in the news and have been in the news. One of them was Bill Clinton. After graduating from law school, John O'Leary returned to Portland to practice law. Had a very international practice, became close to Senator George Mitchell, who was the majority leader of the Senate. And Senator Mitchell urged Mr. O'Leary, who was involved in local politics, to run for Congress. As near as I can tell from his CV, that was the only thing he's ever attempted in his life that he didn't succeed at. But the voters decided that he was more valuable as a member of the Portland City Council than as a congressman. And when his old friend Bill Clinton was elected president, he called John, who was practicing law, and asked him if he would like to be on the Court of Appeals. At that time, he was not ready to give up the practice of law and trade that life for the life of a judge. And so he said, no, but if something else comes along, please keep me in mind. Well, several years later, President Clinton called him again asked him if, because of his knowledge of hemispheric trade and politics, if he would consider being ambassador to Chile. And he accepted the invitation and served as our ambassador from 1998 to 2001. During his time there, he negotiated a free trade agreement between the United States and Chile, one of only six that have been negotiated with any country, and the only one with any Latin American country. John is now engaged in strategic planning for international businesses from an office in Washington and maintains a home in Maine as well. So it's a great pleasure to welcome to the Miller Center a distinguished American diplomat, Ambassador John O'Leary.
George, thank you very much indeed. It is a great pleasure for Patricia and for me to be with you here today at the university and at the Miller Center to talk about issues of great interest, I think, to our country and the Americas and the world, and to do that in the midst of the political season and try to still step back from that and put some of these issues that are very much in play in the campaigns in a little broader context. I know of the great work that this center has done in the study of the presidency, and I was just looking at the magnificent library and the collection there, and a very important intersection of our national politics and international policy is is trade policy, and that's, of course, what I want to speak about today. But I have to also say one personal word. It is an absolute delight for me to be here with my old friend and college classmate, Mac Thompson. Mac and Elsie have been so hospitable to us. And as I was thinking about this last night over a wonderful dinner, our friendship is now 40 years old, so I like to think of this occasion as maybe the beginning of the next 40 years of that friendship. But when Mac and I were in New Haven together a long time ago now, I was thinking last night on the same campus, more or less at the same time, were fellow students named George W. Bush, John Kerry, Howard Dean, Joe Lieberman, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, a dear friend who I first knew my sophomore year, J. Harvey Wilkinson, who's now, of course, a very distinguished judge on the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, and the kind of person who helped keep all those serious people not from getting too serious, Gary Trudeau, who was doing then what he does now so well as putting things in a broader context. And I thought, wow, if you think back to the Yale campus in the late 60s and the early 70s, and that's a lot of young political talent, and I thought of President Kennedy's wonderful phrase, if you got all those people together in one place at that age and say, gee, that's promising political talent, and then you say that's almost as promising as when Thomas Jefferson sat down by himself to dinner here about. So it's great to be here, and Mac and Elsie, thank you so much. What I'd like to do for the next hour or so is divide my time about a half hour by way of focusing on our first free trade agreement in South America and the history of that. I think going into that history and understanding it in a little bit of detail is a perspective worth having, particularly right now when trade issues are very much in our political campaigns. There's a 13-year history to that, which I will do my level best to condense to 13 or 14 minutes. I know the oral history here of 13 days was great, and the full history here would take a long time. But I think it's a very interesting case study at that intersection of domestic politics and international policy of the United States. I want to spend just a moment or two in talking about what the agreement that went into effect January 1 is doing for both countries. And I think it is a win for both countries. Then I want to spend just a few minutes talking about the Chile bilateral agreement in the larger framework of what's going on at free trade in the Americas, and then the global issues that we read so much about today at the WTO and elsewhere. Let me begin with just one piece of context that I think is very important for all of us to understand. The last time I counted, I think there were 191 member states in the United Nations. As we sit here this morning talking about these issues, the fact is that we have trade agreements of various kinds with many countries on particular products or particular issues. But we have free trade agreements, agreements where basically two countries open their economies as fully as they possibly can to each other across the board, trade, investment, services, and so forth. We have free trade agreements now with six. That's the universe we're talking about. And this is a relatively new area of endeavor in the world and for our country. The history is very short. It begins in the 80s in the Reagan administration, where we reached our first bilateral free trade agreement with Israel. In the 90s, 93, of course, the Canada and Mexico agreements that became the NAFTA. In December of 1993, and then followed Jordan, that President Clinton negotiated and that President Bush got through our Congress in 2001, and then Chile and Singapore, which together, and I'll go into that history in a little bit of detail for you, President Clinton initiated in November of 2000, and President Bush brought to conclusion and brought to a successful vote in our Congress. So we're pretty much on the frontier here on some very sensitive issues in a world that is much smaller today, much more globalized today than it was in the early 1980s when the idea of free trade agreements for the United States first came on the agenda. Okay, in that context, let me give you a concise summary of the key points in the 13 years between 1991 and 2004 on the engagement between Chile and the United States that led us basically to open our borders to each other on trade and investment and all that comes with this trade agreement. The history begins as at the only level that really matters here, which is at the presidential level. In 1991, President Bush and President Elwin, who was the first democratically elected president after the restoration of democracy to Chile, which had such a great tradition of democracy that was obviously interrupted for a number of years, they first talked about the idea that our country and that long, thin country at the bottom of South America had a lot in common and shared values that made it worth thinking about doing this kind of agreement. Commitment to democracy, to free markets, to human rights, to the rule of law, kind of a cultural fit that made it worth exploring. And the Chileans got very excited about that prospect and went right to work. What happened, as often happens, is there's only so much political capital that our president or our country can spend at one time on issues like this. More about that later. And the Bush administration decided to put all of its efforts into the NAFTA, into the trying to reach a free trade agreement with our two immediate neighbors. And the Bush administration almost completed that work, not quite. And when President Clinton took office in 93, he did complete the negotiations. And he completed the negotiations, and this introduces what I really think is the theme I want to focus on, by negotiating side agreements on labor and environment. And the thesis that I want to try to develop with you this morning is that from a U.S. point of view, it is absolutely critical that our country continue to deal smartly with the intersection of free trade, environment protection, and labor rights. That is how you build a bipartisan international trade policy for the United States. And I think as we walk through the history of the Chile Agreement, I think a great reason for its ultimate success in our Congress, which at the end of the day is the measure of whether the negotiators got it right or not, whether they negotiated an agreement that's in our national interest. And obviously the Congress and the other country has to negotiate, has to figure that out for itself. But that has a great deal to do with finding some common ground on those very sensitive issues of labor, environment, and trade. But anyhow, after those side agreements were negotiated, of course, the NAFTA was approved by our Congress in December of 93. With that done, the next important milestone in thinking about the Chilean case and what it can teach us about where we are and where we're going on this was at the summit in Miami, the first summit of the Americas, which was held in December of 1994. And that brought together the heads of state of the 34 democratic governments of our hemisphere, market economies. Hopefully someday we'll be able to say 35, but it is today, as it was then, 34. And at the conclusion of that summit, some of you will recall, the presidents of the three NAFTA countries stood with the president of Chile, Eduardo Frei, in Miami at the closing session, and the cameras were running, as they are here this morning, with many more cameras and for many more news organizations, of course. And the three presidents invited Chile to apply for accession to the NAFTA, to become what Prime Minister Crediani called, and it seemed like a very felicitous phrase at the time, the fourth amigo. And with that very public invitation to Chile to dance at the presidential level, and with the president of Chile accepting in public the invitation to dance, we didn't have no dance. And the reason we didn't have no dance, the reason the negotiations for Chile's accession to the NAFTA never got started back then, has to do with our own U.S. domestic political issues. Every country has political issues on free trade, but ours were whether the president would have what was then called fast-track authority, the ability to go out and have his negotiators, and these are extraordinarily complex negotiations, negotiate an agreement with negotiators from another country, and then bring that back to the Congress for a yes or no vote. No maybes, no amendments. The idea is no country would sit down and go through all of that effort if either country's Congress could change it. They can reject it if they don't agree with it, but they can't change it. President Clinton was unable after NAFTA to get fast-track authority renewed, and he was unable to get it renewed, in my judgment, in large part because we could not figure out in our Congress the answer to a tough question, but life is full of tough questions, and our elected officials are paid to try to figure out the answers to them, difficult as they may be, but they couldn't figure out the answer to the question, how does labor and environment relate or not relate to trade? And that pretty much brought a halt to the Chilean discussions again. They picked up in 98 in a way when the second Summit of the Americas was held in Santiago. Again, 34 heads of state. Two important things happened. The one that got all the news, understandably so, was the presidents of the heads of state of the countries launched the free trade area of the Americas negotiations with the objective of reaching a 34-way free trade agreement in our hemisphere by January 1, 2005. I'll come back to that toward the end of my comments, and I'll be happy to talk about that if you'd like in the question and answer session. But the second thing that happened that was critical in moving the Chile-U.S. negotiations forward was there was established a joint commission on trade and investment at the highest levels of the two governments in this area, our U.S. Trade Representative and her counterpart, to meet on an annual basis. Everything in Washington, most of you well know, gets reduced to an acronym sooner or later. And the awful acronym for the Joint Commission on Trade and Investment was the JICTI. And the idea of the JICTI was to really talk about what the framework of negotiations would look like if we ever began negotiating. Now, for those of you who haven't had the honor and the pleasure to serve in the diplomatic corps, getting to the point where you can begin to talk about what your talks might look like might not seem like a whole lot of progress. For a diplomat, that is a giant leap forward. And those talks began in 1998. They went on for 3 years. But essentially, when I got to Chile in July of 98, against that background, where we were, and it's important to try to understand this from the other country's perspective, just like if you were negotiating a business agreement, the odds of success are greater, or any kind of agreement, if you understand where the other party's coming from and try to find the common ground. But the mood in Chile in July of 1998, when I arrived, was essentially, and we have wonderful relations with Chile these days. The U.S. ambassador is able to talk to the government, to the opposition, to the business community, to labor leaders, to environmental leaders quite openly and candidly. And what people would say to me when I first got to Chile is, Mr. Ambassador, if the United States wants to talk about a free trade agreement with Chile, why don't you come over to La Moneda, which is the Chilean White House, the day the Congress of the United States gives the President of the United States authority to negotiate with fast track approval. That was where we that was the price we paid for the inability in our congressional politics to figure out where the common ground was on labor, environment, and trade. It was a sunk cost as far as Chile was concerned. It didn't affect a superb bilateral relations, but free trade negotiations were dead in the water until we could come back and address these issues. What changed to get us going? Let me point to a couple of things, and they really come in the initiative, as I observed it, from the Chilean side in the first instance. In 1999, Chile had a new foreign minister who came up and met with Madeleine Albright in August and basically said, we've changed our mind. We are tired of waiting for the U.S. political system to figure out the answer to this tough question and get faster. We will do what no other country in the world was prepared to do at the time and sit down and negotiate without fast track authority. And it was a very important signal. Chile is a country, and those of you who focus a bit on Latin America, as I do, understand Chile is a real standout in Latin America today. And part of the reason they're a standout is they've had a commitment over more than 20 years now that basically says, look, The economic future of our country depends on being plugged into the economies around the world. And we recognize we can only do that if it's a two-way street. And Chile has been vigorously pursuing trade agreements around the world. And this willingness to negotiate with us without fast track was a very important signal. A second thing that Chile did that distinguished itself from almost every other country in the world and ultimately brought it to the short list was at the second annual JICTI meeting in Santiago in the fall of 1999, when the United States said back to the Chileans, we've heard what you just said. You're willing to open negotiations at the risk that what we agreed to may not be the deal at the end of the day. But we don't want to waste your time. We know you don't want to waste our time. We really can't begin to sit down and negotiate unless you tell us that labor and environmental issues will be on the table with trade, investment, and everything else. I remember the moment vividly because I think it was one of the most decisive moments in the ultimate success of these efforts over three administrations in our government. A table pretty much the size of this, on one side the Chileans, on the other side those of us from the United States. And Alejandro Jara, who was Chile's chief negotiator at this point, not negotiator, there was nothing to negotiate, chief representative, didn't miss a beat. And he said, yes, we can do that. And then he said, we don't know what you mean by that. And quite frankly, if you had polled the seven or eight of us on this side of the table, there wasn't one of us who knew what we meant by it either, in terms of what the outcome would be, what the terms of engagement would be. But everybody in that room knew, and the Chileans were smart enough to know instantly, that unless they could figure out with us a way to deal with labor rights and environmental protection in the context of trade, we wouldn't have an agreement that would pass political muster in the United States. And nobody wanted to waste the time and effort of these negotiations if the outcome was going to be a political failure. We were ready to go shortly after that when, as often happens in life and in diplomacy is no different, something unrelated brought all of this to a halt for a time. You'll remember the Seattle WTO meeting in December of 1999, where that just got completely off track in every respect. And it happened just at the time we were prepared to go back to Chile and say we're ready to negotiate. We've cleared away the key issues. And we couldn't. And we couldn't because the judgment in Washington, with which no one in Santiago could disagree, I certainly couldn't, was we had just concluded negotiations with China to bring China into the World Trade Organization. And though that agreement, the terms of that were coming to our Congress in the year 2000, an election year like this year, and the judgment in the administration was we've only got so much political capital to spend, we can't take on any other trade issues. I want to come back to that maybe in the Q&A about where we are with votes this year on trade issues. And then two things happened again, as they always do, that you didn't anticipate and you had to figure out what that meant in terms of a project we were very focused on. Two things happened in that election year. China, as you all know, ultimately got approved. But while that was before our Congress, two things happened that moved the Chilean ball forward. And I think this is important to understanding how things happen in the real world. First, the United States decided at President Clinton's behest to open up trade negotiations with Jordan. And the President's judgment then, and in my judgment in retrospect, the correctness of this is even clearer, but his view was that if we were to do everything we could to try to bring peace to the Middle East, one of the things we ought to do is engage with countries that had been constructive in terms of trying to find ways where neighbors could live in peace and not the terrible tragedies that we've seen in the last few years. So Jordan had sent some very positive signals in that direction. And the United States decided to engage Jordan to try to negotiate our first free trade agreement with an Arab Muslim country. As I mentioned, our first free trade agreement of all was with Israel. Those negotiations succeeded. The Chileans were disappointed, very disappointed, that they weren't the ones who were selected to become our fourth free trade partner, but they certainly understood the international calculus behind going to Jordan. Jordan succeeded. And I remember this vividly because at our third annual JICTI meeting, which was in Washington the week of the election, November of 2000, Charlene Barshefsky sat at the table again, pretty much the size, and explained to the Chileans that this was a very important agreement because for the first time, labor and environment had been addressed in the context of the agreement. And what Barshefsky said to the Chileans is, this a few weeks before the election, this is going to have to go to the new Congress. The new administration's going to have, whoever wins the election, going to have to decide what to do with this. But if the new Congress approves the general framework for dealing with labor and environmental trade has been approved for Jordan, I'm going to leave a note to my successor, whoever that is, make Chile next. And I remember making a long flight back to from Washington to Santiago and saying to him, we've tried, we did our best, we pushed that rock up the hill every chance we got, but it's not going to happen on my watch. This will be for the next ambassador to have to deal with. And then a funny thing happened. In Brunei, I walked into my office one morning in late November, mid-November, and I had some information that suggested that the president was at an APEC meeting in Brunei, the Association, the Asian Pacific Economic Council, and on a golf course with the Prime Minister of Singapore, it had a discussion about whether Singapore and the United States should begin negotiating our fifth free trade agreement. You can understand what my reaction was when I heard that piece of information. And once I was scraped off the ceiling and had confirmed that the information was correct, had nothing to do with say, please get me the president, we need to talk. The president was in Air Force One in Asia, and some calls were made back and forth, and some discussions were had. And the following Tuesday, Representative Clinton called President Lagos and asked him if Chile would like to become our next free trade partner as well. And this, I think the timing of this is important to think about in the historical terms, because again, this is how things often happen. This call is made 3 weeks after our presidential election. The date was November 27, 2000. Some of you in this room may recall, on November 27, 2000, we didn't know who had won our election 3 weeks earlier. And I can assure you, the president of Chile had no more insight into the evolving law of hanging chads in the jurisdiction of Florida than any of us did. But he took a chance. He knew Clinton was a lame duck. He didn't know who the new administration was going to be. He might very well have been able to say, have been justified to say, Mr. President, thanks, but we'll wait to see whether we're dealing with Bush or Gore here. But he didn't. He said, let's do it. Let's start the negotiation. And that's when they began, and that's how they began. Now, to my point that this is an issue where it's critical for the United States to try to find our national interest and to try to find that on a bipartisan basis. After President Bush won the election, there was obviously a real question as to whether these negotiations would continue or not. The president was absolutely in his prerogative, and those of us in the outgoing administration knew it, to say, look, we don't do bilateral trade agreements, or we're not going to continue with these, or we're going to change the architecture of those negotiations. And I think two things that I would flag for you that were awfully important in the history here. Number one, Bob Zeller, the U.S. Trade Representative, on the first trip he made to any country in the world came to Chile. And I served for a few months in the transition, so I was there when he was there. And he asked off to do the usual things. He wanted to meet the president of Chile, he wanted to meet the foreign minister, he wanted to meet the trade minister. And he said to me, I want to meet with the labor and environmental leaders of Chile. And I said, this is an important request. I wish we'd thought of that here in the embassy. We didn't, but it's a great request, and let's honor it. And we had two meetings around a dinner table at the ambassador's residence, one with our U.S. trade representative, Chilean labor leaders, one with environmental leaders. And the signal that sent, and Bob Zelick is very conscious of the signals he sends, as anyone in his position needs to be, and he had a Wall Street Journal reporter with him who reported the next day on those meetings, was that the old debate, and I think it had become an unfortunately partisan debate, and we don't need to go into that today, but the old debate, which was do trade and labor and environment have anything to do with each other or not, ended with that.
because here you had a new Republican administration that was prepared to deal with labor and environment. The former Democratic administration had insisted be on the negotiating table and do that. And when President Bush and President Lagos first met in the Oval Office in April of that year, I can assure you that no one who was with them in that room when they talked about this had any misunderstanding that the President of the United States, the new President, was committed to getting these negotiations done. And he told that to the President of Chile. On the political, so that, it seems to me, is a very important recognition of the movement toward a bipartisan approach at the executive level. In the Congress, and let me conclude this part with a quick summary there, it's not quite so easy, particularly in the House. And as these negotiations, Clinton wants, why should this take more than 3 months? This is Chile, it's a perfect fit. They took 2 years to get done. But along the way, something very important happened in 2001. President Bush went back, fought very hard, spent real political capital to get Trade Promotion Authority, as they renamed Fast Track, and got it by the overwhelming margin of one vote, 215 to 214. And nobody wants to go into great detail how that particular sausage was made, but it was made in the usual Washington way. So the president then had, in the midst of these negotiations, the ability to go out to have his negotiators, teams of more than 100 negotiators in more than 20 different areas on each side, do their very best to come up with an agreement that could walk away from the table and say, this is good for our country, in stereophonic sound, and bring it back. And when it came back to our Congress, with TPA authority last year for a vote, I think the outcome of the vote, and again, if you just look at trade issues right in this moment, which is a snapshot in time and at the outset of a presidential campaign, you'll appreciate, even if you don't follow trade issues, what a testament this was to the effort that was made. The vote in the House was 270 to 156 for the Chile Free Trade Agreement. 75 Democrats in the House voted for it, up from 21 who had voted for the Trade Promotion Authority. In the Senate, similarly, 66 to 31. And as a former lawyer, recovering lawyer, haven't done that for a few years, but I tell you, that to me is the jury. When the jury comes back on behalf of the United States people, it's our Congress. And that vote was, it seems to me, a vote of confidence in what the negotiators accomplished and what three presidents, two Republicans and one Democrat, had moved forward. Now, briefly, where we are, the agreement went into effect January 1st. I think we're going to see excellent benefits on both sides and flows of trade. Chile had a 6% across-the-board tariff, except for free trade partners, and they had a number of free trade partners. So if you manufactured, for example, one of the leaders of the business coalition in Washington was Caterpillar. If you manufacture a big piece of heavy equipment, Chile's the largest copper mining country in the world. They buy a lot of heavy equipment. If something made in Iowa started out at a 6% disadvantage to something made in a country that Chile had a free trade agreement with, for example, our friends in Europe, that's gone. It's now zero. It's an even playing field, and an American business and American worker does not start out 6% behind the curve in a very competitive world. So those things are moving forward. I think even more importantly, for those of you who follow the Americas present far more challenges. When I was first in Chile not so long ago in 98, I think most of us thought this hemisphere was on cruise control. Democracy, free markets, let's pay attention to the parts of the world that have real challenges. The Americas today have real challenges, and I think there are tremendous strategic advantages to us in reaching agreements with good partners like Chile that will, I think, help as we try to think about how the more challenging cases like Venezuela, or Peru, or Bolivia, or Haiti in today's news can be dealt with. Finally, let me say this in terms of where we're going on this. I think President Clinton understood, and certainly Bob Zoellick, with the full endorsement of President Bush, understood that the Chile agreement and our first agreement in Asia with Singapore were not just about the little speck of a country in Asia and that long, thin country in Chile. If these were done right, they had a catalytic value. We could learn from them and apply those lessons down the road. We have now completed. The Bush administration decided to start with Central America. They just completed negotiations with free trade agreement with five Central American countries. Last week, they completed our second free trade agreement in Asia with Australia. I was with the ambassador of Morocco the other night at the embassy of Bahrain. Morocco is very close to completing negotiations, and we're starting next month negotiations with Bahrain. We have a five-way negotiation going on in South Africa and its neighbors. And near and dear to my heart and to Patricia's heart, the president announced, and I can tell you it has very important strategic value, his intention to begin free trade negotiations with Colombia and with Peru. Each of these is going to have to be taken on its own. I think the right question at the end of the day for our elected representatives and really for our negotiators is, have we negotiated an agreement with a country who, in our judgment, earns a right to openness with us, is a free trade partner we can count on to be open, to be transparent, to be sensitive to labor rights, to be sensitive to environmental issues. I don't think a whole lot's going to happen on these agreements in this Congress. Again, I can talk about that more in the Q&A session. But I do think that the difficulties of doing, I think the WTO now has 148 members. Those of you who are business people or lawyers, I just ask yourself the last time you tried to do a 148-sided negotiation. It's complex. And that's going to be very, very challenging. And the issue of agricultural subsidies, on the one hand, intellectual property rights, and the other, consensus. But I do think these bilateral agreements, as the case of Chile shows, if done with the appropriate care and sensitivity and with the right partner, can be a very valuable way to move forward in an increasingly globalized economy, which isn't a change, and to set up rules of engagement that can offer economic opportunity and strategic value to both sides. And I think an absolute key to that is building as much as we can a bipartisan understanding in this country of how the trade, labor, and environmental pieces fit together. In my judgment, Chile and Singapore are a very important beginning in that process that's going to take a very long time, but I think it's important to understand what succeeded and what didn't in this to understand how we can connect in this area in the future.
James.
Who would like to ask the first question of Ambassador O'Leary?
Ambassador, you alluded, I think, a little bit to a gentleman that I didn't hear you mention specifically, but he had tremendous influence in South America in regard to developing a market system, and that's Hernando de Soto. Could you comment a little bit about him, especially if you've had an opportunity to meet him?
I haven't met with him. The work he's done and the experience he's written about in Peru is obviously a very, very important part of the literature of understanding this and these issues. And I noted, and I just want to flag the Peruvian piece because it illustrates a point I was making. Some of you may have seen stories in the press today about whether President Toledo, who was democratically elected at the end of the Fujimori regime, now has 7.5% popularity rating, which is the lowest in the Americas. And the issue is whether his government's going to survive. What does that have to do with market issues in the Americas and trade? Let me try to make the connection. And let me sort of, you can do this contrast if you're doing it on a comparative basis between Peru, Chile's immediate neighbor. You can do it in Argentina, which is Chile's immediate neighbor across the Andes. What I think is very important to understand about the Chilean experience in terms of markets, political stability, and therefore the neighborhood in which we live is this. The introduction in a major way to a market economy in Chile. And the movement away from the command and control economy and economic theory that dominated Latin American thinking a generation ago was really the result of the introduction of the Chicago Economists, the Chicago Boys, as they're known in Chile, during the military regime of the Pinochet government in the early 80s, 82 or so it started. What's remarkable about the Chilean case, in contrast with the Peruvian case, contrast with the Argentine case in my judgment, is that in the three elected governments, democratically elected governments since the plebiscite that brought an end to the Pinochet government, is the same commitment to market principles is applied. In other words, Eduardo Frei, and like Elwin, and now the president of Chile, Ricardo Lagos, who was about to be Allende's ambassador to Moscow at the time of the coup, who came to the United States in exile, who got his PhD at Duke and taught at North Carolina. I may have those reversed, but it's those two schools. It makes basketball tough for him sometimes, who he's cheering for. But anyhow, Lagos has kept the same vigorous commitment to an open economy, to a market economy, to the rule of law, and on all the other issues you'd expect, but those economic continuities are there. He negotiated a free trade agreement with the European Union last year, just before us. He negotiated, and his government, of course, the first free trade agreement that South Korea has with any country in the world. For those of you who follow trade closely, you'll notice that there are demonstrations in Seoul in front of the legislature by agricultural groups in Korea who are upset with any kind of free trade agreement. These issues aren't just U.S. issues, they're around the world. But the fundamental point I'd make to you is, if you did a comparison between Peru, Argentina, and Chile, you will see that what puts Chile in the strongest economy right now in the world, government that has more than 50% of approval from its people, a solid democracy, openness, is that commitment to a market economy. It's very important.
One of the hot buzzwords in this electoral season is exportation of American jobs. And it is often connected to NAFTA or other free trade agreements. Can you shed some light on this connection, if it exists? I cannot see it logically unless, for example, when a company in the United States buys software from India, do they pay a duty on that? Or
this is right at the intersection that I was talking about, domestic politics and international trade policy, and it's got to be addressed. The talking about free trade agreements and opening your economy is always easier in any country when you're going through part of a cycle that looks like there's real growth. Even in that context, it's not easy. I mean, the fact is that millions and millions of jobs were added after somebody said that NAFTA was going to be a great sucking sound. In 1994, through the end of 2000, the Clinton administration, millions and millions of jobs are out of the United States. The fact is that right now, we've, over the last several years, lost a couple of million jobs. And that's a very, I think President Clinton used to say about free trade, and others have, and any economist and political scientist will tell you this, that the benefits of free trade are generalized. Everybody shares in fact that when you take tariffs, which obviously are taxes on imports, down, every consumer saves money, lower price. In the general economy, particularly in an economy like ours where exports are important, in a globalized economy, benefits. The difficulty is that not everybody wins with free trade in any country. And those losses are very particularized. If somebody believes, and in many cases there's a basis for the belief, I lost my job because my employer moved the plant to somewhere else, that doesn't reduce the pain to know what caused it. Here's what I think. I think it's very important to separate out what's going on in the world generally with productivity and competitiveness and a world that's much more integrated than it's ever been with what free trade agreements do. I mean, when you think about China or India or other countries, we don't have free trade agreements. We've got to be very careful in who we negotiate them with, but we don't have agreements that open our economies. You're seeing things that go on outside the context of free trade agreements in a free world. Now, in the NAFTA case, my judgment is the best data I've seen, and I'm not an economist, but probably you can look at 500,000 jobs or so that moved south at a time when we were creating literally tens of millions of jobs, more than 10 million jobs in the States. The idea that there was a giant second south just wasn't true. And I think our border with Mexico is, I think Mexico's stronger. I think there's a democracy there in no small part because of the economic openness. These are connected issues. The one last thing I would say, and I know the sensitivity of this, and in an election year, it's awfully, awfully sensitive. But on the issue of and I pulled some data on this because it is important we understand it. The U.S., since 1995, has lost 11% of our manufacturing jobs. Okay. Around the world, more than 22 million factory jobs have gone, including Japan, which has lost 16%, China, 15%, Brazil, here in our hemisphere, 20% of its manufacturing jobs. I'm not an economist, but the intersection between productivity gains and manufacturing, we're going through a very important change, like the Industrial Revolution and the information age and so forth. And I think we've got to be very careful to separate out things which have their own economic dynamic from the ultimate argument as to whether, on the whole, our country or other countries are benefited by economic liberalism. My own judgment, my personal judgment, is we are. And more than that, if I can just refer to the Central American case for a second, I think strategically, the basic choice of connection and disconnection, integration, disintegration, multilateralism, unilateralism, those are all the sort of paths in the road. We are much better off if our neighbors in Central America are trying to promote economic openness, democracy, human rights, and have a sense that their future has some promise as well than we were not so long ago when none of those hopes was real. And I think free trade has something to do with that.
Actually, got two things. One is, I think, is it's not just the loss of jobs, but it's the actual loss of industries themselves, which is a little different issue. And the second thing is that, as I recall, the European Union is essentially a free trade entity, and the way they compensate is by what they call value-added taxes. Taxes. What do you think the future of those are in these various agreements?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and Chile is dealing with that right now. For those of you who don't follow this that closely, value-added tax is basically a national sales tax, and in Chile, pre-disagreement, I think it was on the order of 16 or 17% was their value-added tax. They're going to have a loss of revenues from the loss of tariffs, and they're going to have to think about ways of dealing with that, just as we will. And I think each country got to work within the parameters of a free trade agreement is what they can do consistently with that and not. I also think your point is exactly right, that it is not, it's not about jobs, it's about industries moving in a global economy. My home is Maine. I remember as a kid, political campaigns in which the great issues were, how do you keep the textile industry, the shoe industry, in Maine and not in North Carolina or someplace else where there were competitive advantages? It's a painful issue. The state of Maine, there has no textile industry, not to speak of, has no shoe industry. And now other places in this country are facing that on a worldwide basis. I think the key to understand is I can't think of one textile industry or textile industry or shoe industry that has gone somewhere because of a free trade agreement. Quite the contrary. I mean, you have Mexico right now very seriously thinking about whether they're going to be able to hold on to some labor-intensive industries versus other parts of the world. We've got to think carefully of how we deal with that, how we deal with the pain that a global economy causes, and investment, education, retraining, all those things. But I think it's very important to keep clearly in mind carefully negotiated free trade agreements that we would only enter into because, at the end of the day, we thought they were good for us. Otherwise, there's no point in doing it.
Just a moment, please. My voice was loud enough. Anyway, could you comment on some of the environmental issues that were tackled in the negotiations with Chile?
Sure. First, the first issue was whether a developing country like Chile would agree with the most developed country like us that these two issues had anything to do with each other. They're still at, for example, in the free trade area of the Americas, labor and the environment are not in the architecture. The negotiations. So the Chileans agreed with that when they agreed to what I said, that they put it on the table. The second issue in the negotiations was, okay, if you do that, where do you put it? You remember in NAFTA, this issue was dealt with as a side agreement. In Chile, as in Jordan, it was dealt with in the agreement itself. It's a separate chapter, chapter 19 of the agreement. Now, the agreement is hundreds and hundreds of pages long. It's available if you want it at www.usdr.gov. If you go to the USDR's website and print out the agreement, don't push the print button first, because you won't have enough paper in your printer to do it. But if you want the environmental chapter, it's about 10 pages. You can print it out. What you'll see is that chapter deals with the toughest issue that I saw in the negotiations, and the one that almost prevented them from getting started, which is the issue of, okay, what are the terms of the agreement? What are the countries agreed to? In the Chile-U.S. case, the government-to-government agreement is, the core of it, is that both countries commit that they will not fail to enforce their own national environmental and labor laws. That's the key commitment. And what that ultimately means is a question for our Congress that our Congress had to decide was, does Chile have the kind of environmental and labor laws, the provisions of parallel, and critically important, the ability to enforce those laws that makes it worthy of a free trade partner of the United States? If the answer to that question is no, this agreement would not have been approved. The most difficult issue of all in the Chilean agreement in negotiations was, what do you do if one country said, if Chile said, hey, you're not systematically enforcing your environmental laws, the United States? Or the shoe could be on the other foot, obviously. What do you do? And the issue that was worked out, and was a very tough one, was whether you can have trade sanctions, increasing tariffs, or putting quotas as a remedy, or whether you have a system of fines, which is what the Chileans preferred. It ultimately turned out to be a compromise position, where in the first instance, there are fines at a very, very high level, and the money for those is then devoted to improving environmental labor enforcement and so forth in the country, and then you get a system of sanctions. The last thing I'd say, and I think it's not a small point, there's also an environmental cooperation term of the agreement, where the two governments agree to cooperate on environmental issues. There's a parallel agreement on labor. And in my old days as a lawyer, I spent a little bit of time on environmental issues, and I know a little something about them. And one of the things I'm glad to say is happening already. I was in Santiago a couple of weeks ago, and USTR and a counterpart agency in Chile actually set up, they had agreed to do a series of programs on corporate stewardship of the environment. And they brought together three projects and invited a broad group of Chileans, one a U.S. copper company that explained what it is doing in environmental protection. They brought together a Chilean forestry company that has just reached a really landmark agreement on protection of old forests with national and international NGOs, and a project I happen to be involved in for a U.S. firm, Goldman Sachs, that has acquired 800,000 acres of forestry land in the very south of Chile through a distressed debt, and has the intention, which it will execute, to give those lands to the people of Chile as a conservation reserve. And so my point is you're already seeing discussions that aren't directly related to trade, but I think are good for the environment that come out of the agreement.
¿Cómo está?
Bien, gracias.
Bien, bueno. I think the greatest issue in these trade deals is not if like the poor benefit marginally from globalization, but rather how to distribute the benefits of globalization more evenly. And I've learned that the more unequal society is, the harder time it has benefiting from free trade and from economic growth. Like Chile being the seventh most unequal society in the world, how do you think a free trade agreement can help like distribute trade's benefits more evenly, like for example between the comunas of Santiago, Las Condes, or Puente Alto? How can there be more egalitarian distribution? So
that's an excellent question. You probably read Amy Chua's book, the Yale law professor, who's written very much on that, called World on Fire. The first, let me talk about this generally, and then let me talk about Chile. And I think this is something we Americans or North Americans, as we're looked at from the South, have to understand, that it is critically important that we come up with trade agreements that make sense for U.S. workers and U.S. business and for our country. Again, otherwise there'd be no point in this exercise. But it's also critically important in negotiating with other countries that we understand that we're trying to achieve agreements which at the end of the day make engagement with another country, whether it's Central America or Chile or Morocco or Jordan, better for them as well. It has to be really important.